With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
16 teams or 24? Rabbit mascots or semi-forgotten lions? Mozart or basement jacks? Dishy Dez or Jim the Pro Rosenthal? Golden goal or penalties? And Craig Charles's brave boner? Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés and the Perfect Euros. Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £1 a month for 6 months. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/clichéspod to take advantage of this special discount. That's theathletic.com/clichéspod. Hello everyone, welcome to episode 73 of the Football Clichés podcast. This is the precise moment, in fact, that Euros previewing hits its saturation point with this. We're building the perfect Euros. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me is Charlie Eccleshare. How much previewing can you handle? Are you previewed out?
I don't think I've actually previewed in a way as much as previous ones. I mean, I think in 96, 2000, those tournaments, from more or less the moment the season finished, I was in full preview mode. And it's interesting now seeing how, you know, there are just so many different avenues that the media can go down. Whereas back then it was, you know, the more perfunctory team guides, a bit on the stadia, and that was about it. So, I mean, it feels like there's far more scope now than ever before. And even that felt like a lot of preview stuff. So I'm not quite at saturation point yet.
Okay, sounds like you've got another hour at least.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
To preview this tournament. Alongside you, Nick Miller. I know you're almost previewed out because you've been telling me about your wall chart woe.
Well, it's not so much wall chart woe, it's just a kind of, I don't know, controversial break from the form by the Sunday Times, who have this year gone with a circular wall chart.
Okay.
It's obviously, this is key content for visual content for a podcast, but if I can describe it, they have the groups in sort of sections around six sections around the edge of a circle, and then as you go closer to the middle of the circle, it goes towards the final. So the final is right in the middle in a kind of standard format, and then the semi-finals are above that, and then the quarterfinals are around that.
Do you have to rotate it? You have to rotate your wall chart to read it?
There is a way of kind of, you don't have to, you can just sort of, you know, tilt your head.
Turn your body, right? So it's a mountain to Muhammad situation.
Exactly. Right? You have to do an awful lot of work to actually get the most out of this wall chart. I don't know. I applaud the the innovative thought. We all like people who try things differently, but why kind of meddle with a format that has worked for literally generations?
Charlie, I thought this was just a portrait versus landscape debate. Now we're going 360 degrees.
Obviously, they have to be done group by group, and they have the fixtures, et cetera, et cetera. But what I want to know really is day by day almost. So what that, I don't want to have to cross-reference and be like, okay, so on the 11th of June, you've got two group Bs and a group D or whatever. I prefer the simplicity of just knowing, right, okay, June 13th, that's going to
be. Yeah, I'm a TV schedule guy. I want to know what's on my telly. I don't care about who's beating who, because that will be explained.
And I want a very clear delineation of who's going to play who in which, you know, in the event of who finishes where. Which, I mean, it is rendered almost pointless by the third place, you know, going through. It could be anyone, really, in those games. So the wall chart on that basis on something of a hiding for nothing. But yes, I agree. I want I want day by day, and then I want a very clear bracket.
An early ripple there of irritation at the current Euros format, which we will dig into as we start to construct our perfect Euros in part two. But part one, as always, guys, is the adjudication panel. First of all, Nick, some classic cricket football crossover for you here. This is Mark Wood in the Test against New Zealand, really pulling out the retro references. Asprilla and Ketsbaya. That's my kind of cricketer.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if it's a Newcastle fan or a Newcastle cricketer who's kind of pulling out football references, you've got to go retro. You can't kind of go in, dash in for a run out and go, Matty Longstaff!
That's, yeah, very true. Yeah, he was he's very much stuck into a corner there. But Charlie, I mean, I suppose it's the scenario in cricket that he had there where he was the ball was grounded and he had the potential for a run out and his only option was to kick it at the stumps. But it released this kind of very childish impulse in him, and it's something I've always been told that people did in the playground. I don't ever remember doing this sort of shouting a player's name as I kick the ball. I don't ever remember doing that, but it's wonderfully childish, like really nice.
Yeah, but it must have just been a completely instinctive thing as well that it took him back to just booting a ball. Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, there was that, because there was that kind of classic question to pros, wasn't there? Like, when you were in the playground, who did you pretend to be? I mean, I remember with my brother, we would simulate, sort of, I would go in goal as the classic right. younger brother. I'd go in goal while he took shots at me as if, in fact, this was in the build-up to Euro 96, as if he would sort of play out a match where he would be Scotland versus England and he'd just sort of narrate it and be like, oh, and Gaz has had a shot, and I'd try and keep it in. But that sort of, then I'd just be, you know, I'd have to be a goalkeeper, which I didn't really want to be. But yeah, like you, I don't remember specifically picking a player and ascribing myself.
Oh, I definitely did that. And Adam, I mean, there is a well-known and I'm going to say quite well-respected journalist as well who still does this.
I know exactly.
Yeah, yeah, freelancers five-a-side football. Yes. But yeah, I'm amazed. I thought everyone did this. You know, they you know, I would, like your brother, would narrate entire games mournfully sometimes.
Oh,
just
that's something else entirely. Oh, okay, right. That's something else entirely. The childish impulse of simply shouting a name when you shoot, that's kind of Roy of the Rovers level. But, you know, commentating over an entire sequence of football, that's thinking man's playground behaviour. Absolutely. I'm fully on board with that, yeah. Speaking of commentary and commentators, poor old John Motson won't be at the Euros for any of the broadcasters this year, but don't worry, Nick, he is well and truly occupied. National Rail have signed him up to front their campaign for safe rail travel. Let's have a little nicely edited montage of what he had to offer them.
Well, hello there. I'm John Motson, and it's delightful that you've joined me at the station where I'm reporting on the tactics people should adopt to travel with confidence. You won't be letting the team down if you get a deliberate booking here. Plan ahead and book a seat where possible. Now, we might have to have another look at this one. The second angle should show us. And yes, we can see there's no contact there. Please maintain distance wherever possible. Look at this. One way, then the other. And oh, what a clean finish. Rail staff are working hard for the team, keeping trains and stations clean.
Nick, I mean, there's so many angles we could go with here, respectfully. But the first of all, it's comforting in a way to see that a proper football commentator still finds it hard to simulate football commentary. Like, they just sounds so wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the classic old problem of recreating football itself in a film. It never looks authentic, seems authentic, and you know, and you can always The other thing is where you will occasionally get for like old footage, you will get a commentator kind of re-commentating the thing, and it's a sign of the you know, the real heads, the way you can tell who is, you know, re-commentating stuff. But I think we really are kind of burying the lead on this Motti thing, which is right. It's only a few seconds and it's right at the start, but he is wearing a sheepskin face mask, which is simply a lovely touch.
It is a lovely touch. Charlie, what's your favourite moment of that? I genuinely do like the deliberate booking reference. That's nicely done. The rest of it, it's 4 out of 10, isn't it?
I mean, the thing is this is what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, and you know, this is that school of like mum passes to dad passes to mum, and it's a girl. I mean, I have no issue with Motson doing this whatsoever. Like, you know, if he's approached to it, absolutely fine. I just find the idea of the people who came up with this ad, and I mean, are they hating it as much as, are they sort of football people who know like this is clearly terrible, but maybe people like it, or is it just people so removed from any knowledge of football? And what's that bit about like the no contact? That, I do struggle just because this has been done so many times, and I can't believe it's still happening. And there's no one in that our imagined kind of football, actual football, sort of what goes on, saying, not sure this really works.
This concept of football as a universal language, I'm not buying it anymore. I think there's just a lot of people who just don't deserve proper football chat, and we shouldn't be kind of trying to approximate it. We need to start rowing back on football marketing speak. It's really starting to annoy me. You mentioned that wearing a sheepskin face mask, Nick, was a nice touch. Well, I've got an even better touch for you here. This is Marcelo Bielsa. Coaching an under-11 side in Leeds, just impromptu by the looks of it. And there are so many obvious jokes here, but it turns out one of them is actually true. He did actually tell them they were going to have to play Murder Ball for 3 hours, which is quite wonderful. A provisional touch classification here, I would say, is classy.
Yes, I think so. Yes. I was a little bit sketchy on the details here. Was this just a kind of local team and he was asked?
Just a local under-11s team.
Right, okay. And it wasn't one of those scenarios where he was just passing by and was looked kind of unimpressed with the coaching standard and just sort of stepped in. Because lovely for the kids, but very, very demoralising for the coach if that's what happened.
I think that could even be pure class. I think
it is a level up.
Yeah, it's slightly beyond class. I think that's pure class from Bielsa, clap hand emoji.
Yeah, I mean, his willingness to just stay local during the summer is quite nice. Listener Sam speculates that the first thing he said to them was, as far as I'm concerned, you can throw all those medals you won in the bin. but yeah, just a lovely scene. Everyone has enjoyed it. Really good pre-Euros content. Well done, everybody. Some of you listeners, Nick certainly included, may remember the triumphant footballing small talk episode a few months ago. I found perhaps the ultimate example in mainstream media. This is from an episode of Pointless this week, and which I think is the ultimate breeding ground for crap footballing small talk. But this is brief, but really does hit the spot.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, Peter, welcome back.
Hi.
Tell us more about yourself, Peter.
Okay, so I'm a driving instructor, then in my spare time I follow Crawley Town for my sins, have done for over 30 years. Started in non-league, followed them right the way through to the Football League.
If anything, Charlie, it's a slight hesitation before he said for my sins. I thought, I've got to say it, I'm on Pointless. He's asked me who I support and what I do. I've got to say it.
It's so good. Yeah, that is just, you just have to, don't you? I'm a long-suffering Swindon fan for my sins. Mm. I hope there might then be a bit more sort of call and response about like, oh, you know, sorry to hear that sort of thing.
Oh, there was.
Oh, okay.
No, there was. I was tempted to include the prolonged conversation, Nick, but I just couldn't do it because Alexander Armstrong does not strike me as a football man. I don't know if he is or not, but the half-heartedness with which he entertains football sporting chat is quite something. It's basically, that's very exciting. Do you go with anyone? Does anyone go with you to these games? And this bloke's saying, I've made some mates. Is that all right? Just stop. Stop. But there's no short way of asking someone who they support, especially on Pointless.
I think we do have to sort of clarify that is a correct use of for my sins. as we established before, if he was Manchester United from our sins, then that's you know, disallowed. But Crawley Town, I think that's fair enough.
But yeah, on that note, let's do part two. Our job today is to create the perfect European championship. Not championships, plural. That's for swimming. That's for athletics. That's for weightlifting. It's just football, so it's one championship. Important style note for everybody there before the tournament. I think we have to start, Charlie, on a really basic, boring technical note. What format do we want our tournament to be? Because, I mean, way back in the day, before many people even considered it canon, you had like four teams involved, which is stupid and pointless. Eight teams feels thoroughly inadequate for the second biggest football tournament on the planet. So are you a 16 or 24 team man?
This is one of those things that shouldn't annoy me as much as it does. But that, changing it from 16, not a day goes by that I don't feel a slight twinge of irritation about that. That was like footballing perfection. 16 teams in the Euros. We know why, the concentration of quality, and I know it's boring, but it was brilliant. 24 in the last Euros, it was, oh, it just became the word permutations. It was just all you could hear was, you know, but if they draw, but then in Group E, Iceland win by one goal. It was so tedious. And it meant the quality was diluted. That was the Euros USP, 16. It had that over the World Cup even, that every team, or almost every team, was pretty good. So I'm a 16-team evangelist. Very, very strong about that.
That's fair enough. But Nick, you seem a slightly more romantic type. You want the Northern Islands to be involved like they were in 2016. That was a good story. A 24 team opened you up to that sort of thing, that sort of novelty. But does it override the fact that you're having best third place teams going through, which is a fact?
No, not for me. I mean, I'm flattered that you think I'm a footballing romantic, and, you know, in many ways I am, but not in this case. What the one okay. thing that I do enjoy with the having after the switch from 24 is very specifically to do with Wales, and so this would frequently get brought up that, you know, well, of course, you know, Wales never got to tournament since 1958, and they've you know, got all the way to the semi-final thanks to this expansion. And that I enjoyed the very brief moment where, just before the Wales fan or Wales part of the Wales team or whatever would jump in and say, well, actually, we would have got there, even if it wasn't 2014, we would have qualified outright.
No,
anyway.
That's fine. Which I completely accept that was right to point out.
But the other thing that the 2014 format scuppers is the group of death, because the point of the group of death is that if there are three massive teams like there are this year in, I forget which group letter it is,
Portugal, France,
Group F, the tension there is that one of those teams is going to go out, and it's just, you know, which one, who's going to bottle it on the big occasion. But the tension is completely taken away by the knowledge that one of them could just scab it through anyway. They can lose to the other big lads and then absolutely pump the fourth place team and waltz through.
I really hoped you were going to say absolutely pump, and you did. So fantastic.
Portugal won. They didn't win a game last time. Squeaked through in third place, and obviously went on to win the whole thing, which I wasn't happy with.
Also, just one thing on that idea that, oh, now the smaller nations can qualify. Yes, it's easier, but they still were able to qualify for the 16-team tournaments. I mean, try telling Latvia in Euro 2004 that small nations, or Scotland in Euro 96. If you're good
enough, you'll get in.
Rather than that sort of thing, it just felt a little bit in Euro 2016. I mean, like Northern Ireland got to the last 16, and you know, that was obviously really exciting. But there was a bit of like, yeah, come on, you get through to the last 16 as well. Like, everyone's welcome. It lost the edge a little bit for me when, as Nick says, you cannot win a game in a group and still like, yeah, you're fine. You come in as well.
Dangerously Anglo-centric start to this episode already. But yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, you shouldn't have a tournament where 45% of the entrants are in straight away. So yeah, 16-team tournament for our perfect Euros. Happy with that. Right down to the micro now, Nick. We're going to talk about our official match ball. I have strong opinions about this. A lot of people just simply don't care whatsoever. That's fine. I mean, there was a distinct tango era, which peaked in 1984 with the Tango Mundial, which was a slightly odd name because it was the European Championships. But it was the tango design, but with slightly nice red lettering on it, which was a lovely touch. So that's my first nomination.
Yeah, I'm a Telstar man. I like the which.
Oh no!
Well, hang on. What's wrong with the pasta?
The generic birthday cardboard.
No, it's got a nice look to it. But I did also like the Tango 12, the sort of the kind of modern tribute in 2012 to the classic old Tango. So I'm going to go with that one. The one, and I'm sorry, Charlie, if this is one you're going to choose, but the one I simply will not expect was. Except was 2004, the grey one. I can't remember what it's called.
No, I'm completely in agreement with you, Nick. Good. I've sort good, of good, seen good. That. To me, it's funny, that ball almost captures like the fashion of that time, of 2004. It just wasn't really a great time. I don't know, like sort of quite baggy, ill-fitting clothes, and that ball just sort of looks a bit like that. Yeah, it's really quite horrible. I mean, the Questa Europa, obviously, the Euro 96 one. I mean, I know... Need to be wary of just Euro 96 being the answer to every question here, because in many ways it can be. But that ball was really, really nice. And I do like those original Telstras, as Adam says. They were, yes, they are that classic football card or stock football ball, but I think there's something quite nice about that.
I understand completely how the Telstar became the generic football of choice. It's just that I just you watch games where it's being played and it just sort of seems to kind of balloon about like a supermarket ball, and I can't take it seriously. But I definitely can't take, as you say, the Euro 2004 ball seriously. Adidas Retero. There is no place for a silver ball at a top level international tournament. It didn't ruin the tournament, but it looking back, it kind of ruins everything about it when you see it. And it's so I'm prepared to strike a happy medium between retro and forward thinking. So I will go with Euro 96 because it was the Questa Europa, the first multicoloured official ball at an international tournament, but not garish and not forgettable like the current one, which is just, you know, little tiny splashes of pink and yellow and green, which no one's ever going to remember. So the Questa Europa from 1996, and that hopefully could be the end of our Euro 96 love-in. I don't want to get the Euro 96 is overrated brigade tuning out straight away. Nick, this is your special area. This is mascots. Can you even name a single European Championship mascot from history? Because I can't.
Can't you? Well, I mean, this shows very, very poor commitment to the thing. What about, you know...
Come on.
let me just bring up the Wikipedia page here. Yes, okay. What about Goliath, Euro 96? No? No, nothing?
Well, I mean...
Badil and Skinner, Gaza, yeah, Goliath.
This is it. I mean, Goliath.
That's the memories.
If it had been done properly, the Euro 96 mascot would have embedded itself in the ongoing cultural Euro 96 bandwagon, just like everything else, all the other obvious things. But Goliath is utterly forgettable, Nick.
Yeah, yes, that I will concede. I'll tell you what isn't forgettable, if you were kind of seen it at the time, was West Germany 1988, Bernie, which is a grey rabbit, which I'm sure was supposed to be kind of, you know, looked adorable, but actually looks a lot like the rabbit from Donnie Darko. It's absolutely fucking terrifying.
But on a more mundane note, this is on a kind of on-running theme about how half-hearted European Championship mascots are. They used it again in 1992, just a yellow one, and the name was changed to simply Rabbit. That's so shit.
That is so last minute, isn't it? Fuck, oh shit, we don't have a mascot.
We've got a mascot.
We don't have a mascot. Just do what we did last time. Do a name, there's no time, just call it Rabbit.
It makes it worse is it's not even that the whole thing is yellow. It's just that there's just the yellow headband. That's it. They haven't even bothered to put the whole thing in a different colour.
Absolutely.
Pinocchio was, by the way, the Italian 1981. I never
didn't
knew
even
that.
Think up their own character.
What was
stole
that?
It from fables.
What has that to do with anything?
I do like Benelucky for firstly for the name, which obviously Netherlands and Belgium 2000.
Yeah, joint host really does kind of make it trickier, doesn't it? To get a lot of portmanteauing.
But they've done it very nicely. So Benelucky was a lion, and they have used the colours of both the Netherlands and the Belgian flag to kind of to sort of divide up his mane. So the common red is at the top, and then on either side you got black and yellow and white and blue. It's and then there appears to be a ball stuck to him as well, with which is slightly strange. But I thought that was quite nice. That was
a very confused affair, isn't it? I mean, there doesn't seem to be a golden era, Charlie, of European Championship mascots, unlike the World Cup, for example. And there doesn't seem to be any reason for that for me. We are in a very, very sort of turgid era now, which is basically just a succession of cartoon boys.
Yeah.
Which are, the latest is Skillsy, which does sound like it was made up by like a sort of year seven child, doesn't it? Skillsy is really shit.
Skillsy sounds like a really desperate attempt to appeal to a younger crowd, especially as it's described. And by the way, this Wikipedia page, I mean, is amazing. For like earnest descriptions of not so serious things, which, you know, a genre we've discussed before, it's really good. But yeah, Skillsy is a character inspired by freestyle football, street football, and panic culture. I'm just like you guys. I'm one of the kids.
I should say that in what can only be described as an extremely on brand development, I was accidentally there when Skillsy was unveiled. It was a game between Netherlands and Germany in Amsterdam, which I, for some reason, persuaded a former employer to send me to cover. Not because I knew Skillsy was going to be there, but that was just an added
bonus. I was going to say, you said
worth it once you came back with that.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
You've got to send me. You're like Kate Adey, but for mascots.
Very much so, yeah. But yes, huge fanfare. And this guy, because this guy was wearing it was obviously wearing the kind of mascot suit. And then he also had two freestylers beside him, who obviously did their very impressive freestyling thing.
I'm so bored of football freestylers, Nick. I'm not impressed. It's not proper football.
It's fine. It's okay. But then the person who was in this Skillsy suit had to do a series of quite clumsy and kind of uncoordinated skills while he had this very cumbersome suit on. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say it was the greatest thing that I've ever witnessed in a football ground, but you know, I was glad I was there.
But more than justified the trip.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
So, Charlie, before we pick essentially the best of a bad bunch here, given that this is a pan-European Euros, a truly pan-European one, I guess that makes the job of picking or designing a mascot even harder. So I'm not surprised they've gone for a generic kind of Skillsy.
Mm.
But what could a pan-European mascot really do? What kind of mascot could encapsulate continental Europe? All I can think of is bad genes.
it's sort of easier in a way because the whole thing, for a kind of sterile thing devoid of personality, as a lot of these mascots have been, and just doing it pan-European feels sort of somehow appropriate. But can I just clarify something as well? So on this, it says the name Benelucky is a portmanteau of Benelux, the term for the three nations of Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg.
Oh, here we go.
So why was... Have I missed something here? Is it Luxembourg didn't... They didn't host a game in Euro 2000.
No, I don't think they did, no.
But why is Luxembourg getting in on the act?
I don't know.
Long history of Luxembourg being patronised in mascot form.
This is extraordinary. This is
imagine if they'd had to build like an 80,000 seat stadium just to get involved.
the ultimate white elephant. Yeah. Well worth it for Benelucky. I'm really baffled by that.
I might have to make the casting vote here. I'm trying to think of the mascot here, which is the least shit. And I think we might have to go with the original rabbit, the 1988 rabbit, Bernie. Suitably childish enough, you're going to appeal to the younger audience. Looks like some effort went into it. The name isn't stupidly football related. The whole thing isn't too convoluted. 1988 Rabbit is my choice for our mascots.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Next one, a hugely important subject, Nick. This, we are going to pick our broadcasting theme tune for our fantasy tournament. This is obviously a BBC versus ITV showdown. So let's take a little potted history through this sort of thing in recent years. This is my personal favourite to start with. This is ITV's Euro 92 theme tune, You Are the Number One. I should have included the saxophones in this clip. But the lyrics are undeniable. You are the number one, you are the best, so just believe it. That has European appeal. Everyone understands that concept of being the best, being number one.
It also sounds like it was recorded by the same people or in the same studio as the Here We Go thing from Sky as well.
I'd love to find the original file of that. That is the Holy Grail. Yeah. Finding the original full version of Here We Go. Not commercially available and very, very annoying. But it's still a very, very solid pop song from the late 80s and early 90s, which I'm very happy with. But I mean, the whole kind of genre of this, which people do look forward to. People look forward to the kind of unveiling of a broadcaster's title music. But it kind of all kind of descended into faux classical minefield, Charlie. It began sort of BBC... in the spirit of Bernie the Rabbit, the BBC just repeated the same song from 1992 to 1996. This was Ode to Joy, which I think was quite jaunty. Had to include the BBC ident there because it's just wonderful, obviously. Charlie, I think this passes one of the crucial tests for a broadcasting title music, is that you could hum it in the kitchen as you go and get another pipe of Pringles or another beer for the lads.
Doritos and dip.
got dip. Where's the dip?
I watched this earlier and it did. Yeah, I really like this one. Ode to Joy, also the most commonly chosen song on Desert Island Discs. I enjoyed there for you. At the time of recording.
Very, very nice. Yeah, so this is potentially an early favourite in this debate. Nick, hot on the heels of that. So as I say, we did get into a kind of faux classical territory. No, we didn't, because we haven't got the clip, so I'll start that again. So after that kind of faux classical era, Nick, BBC in Euro 2000 had Andrea Bocelli singing over the top. But it all came roaring back in Euro 2004 with Basement Jacks, which is the most 2004 choice it could potentially have had. I can't think of a more 2004 choice. But quite unusual to have like a mainstream act kind of delivering the theme tune.
Yeah, because you want to sort of associate it with that tournament and only that tournament, not, you know, some kind of sweaty...
That's dangerous
territory. Yeah, some kind of sweaty club that you've been in 6 months previously. Mm. You think, oh, this is... What I mean, surely that they've missed something of a trick here by sort of ripping off what the Champions League did, which was to commission a theoretically original piece of music, but was just in fact someone putting a bit of a spin on an existing piece of classical music. Mm. So they could just get someone to kind of riff on Ode to Joy a little bit, and it'd become iconic for some reason.
Just mix up the notes. The same year, 2004, ITV went with Max Sedgley's Happy, which is also an incredibly 2004 piece of music. But don't worry, it came roaring back to the classical scene, Charlie, in 2008, when both BBC and ITV both went for Mozart. BBC's Mozart was remixed by Uncle, which is kind of cool. But I think ITV's was arguably superior. Let's hear that. I don't know why we kind of got into this habit of sort of really kind of pushing football to the kind of the cultural kind of echelons that we think, oh, it's a very classy affair, isn't it, this European football? Well, does it need to be? Why did we get so attached to this sort of thing?
Well, this is all the kind of Italian 90. Doesn't Italian 90 have a lot to answer for with this?
Yes, it does.
And I guess they thought Mozart, it being in Austria, you know, they probably both thought, ah, this is quite a good idea. You know, like, ah, bollocks, the other one's done it as well. Footballers' religion and kind of grandiosity and yeah, it's kind of where football was at this point.
Nick, do you think their first port of call is, we need to find a composer from that country, let's see what they've got?
Yeah, and a real kick in the pants for Switzerland in this that year. You know, what they've both gone for...
Who's your favourite Swiss composer, Nick?
Oh, I mean, there's far too many to pick. I couldn't possibly simply land on one.
I'm surprised Luxembourg didn't somehow get involved in this, given... Seems to be muscling their way into Euro.
I don't know any Luxembourgeois musicians, quite frankly. Euro 2016, BBC. This was a very French-tinged piece of music, and again passes the kind of humming test. It was the sort of thing a bit like the World Cup in Brazil theme tunes that you're kind of humming around the house. This was really, really good. I think we're getting closer to the kind of the real sweet spot here. This was lovely. So that was nice. So it's like a modern twist on what was becoming a kind of rather stale affair. But Nick, in 2020, or 2021 rather, the Chemical Brothers are delivering the BBC's title music for the Euros, and which is quite interesting because I feel like the Chemical Brothers could have done any title music from any tournament from the last 20 years. What a crafty decision. Jaunty, it's summery. I feel like this could be the Glastonbury coverage title music.
It's also it's a classic decision of you know, someone who grew up in the 90s is now in a position of commissioning power, kind of going, what do young people like? Chemical Brothers, I liked them when I was young. Let's get them on board. But the sort of sweet spot of you know, I'm sure the Chemical Brothers are doing very well, but let's be honest, they'd probably be available to do this as well.
On the other hand, I mean, Charlie, we should be placing our trust in these people's kind of tastes because, you know, the BBC did bring us that national montage in 2018, which is genuinely accepted to be one of the best months. And that was just for a penalty shootout win over Colombia. It wasn't even that dramatic a moment, really. So I don't know. I think we're in safe hands. But where are you thinking of the sweet spot is here now?
I mean, yeah, it's a tricky one because so. 96 as well had ITV's was Jerusalem, wasn't it? So you had, that was a real ode to joy going head to head with Jerusalem. That's a heavyweight battle. Yeah, but I think you probably do want to move away from that because that was in that sort of 96 to 2008 bit on the space was when the Premier League and football was at its most bombastic. So maybe something a bit more measured, like in France 5 years ago, is a bit more appropriate for the world we now live in.
Yeah, I would go with the 2016 one simply because I don't think I've thought about that piece of music for a second since 2016. But hearing it then took me right back.
The sun just shines as soon as you hear it. It really is a lovely piece of music. I feel like the only kind of opportunity here, perhaps the next tournament needs a kind of Super Sunday style piece of music, which we have covered extensively on this podcast before, which are songs that sound like they've been recorded purely for that purpose, with a bit of a cappella vocal at the end. Maybe that's where we're headed. If Sky ever get the right to a major tournament, we know what's going to happen. They won't be picking classical, that's for sure. So BBC, Euro 2016, that's our choice for our fantasy tournament broadcasting title theme music. But Nick, once that music has died down, who's the first face that's going to greet you from the studio? My shortlist for you, you may have others. Jim Rosenthal, Des Lynam, Gary Lineker, or left field shout, Adrian Childs.
I almost don't want to answer this because we are just slipping back into the Euro 96 thing.
No!
Sorry, it's Des. Sorry.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, going on instinct to this one, he's the first face that that conjures up even more. I associate him even more with Euros and international tournaments in the 90s than I do with Match of the Day, which all grandstand, which he obviously presented for years and years. But yeah, it's Des, I'm afraid.
He went as far as Euro 2004, which kind of actually surprises me, Charlie. I mean, as much as I love Dez in that kind of vague way that I just assume I have to because everybody else does, I wonder, is he the man for the kind of real high-pressure moments?
Well, famously, Dishy Dez, as he was, as we just called him, he had...
How 90s is Dishy Dez?
So good. He had a moment in Italian 90 where he kind of freestyled a little bit and then lost his way, and it really haunted him. But it never happened to get him again. And I think he, you know, he was the consummate professional. So I think he can. I mean, he's obviously associated with the Shouldn't You Be at Work in France 98, which was brilliant. But I remember Euro 96, the Germany game, and it starts, and it's something along the lines of, "Good evening. You must have heard there's a football match on. Sporting history. Waiting to be named."
Bloody hell, that's really good Dez. That is a really good Dez. Lovely little kind of feline growl to it. Yeah. Very good.
But I often think of that, the finishing line of "Sporting history, waiting to be made." Like, I just think of that. I think it's such a great line. And I know, as you said, I'd love to be contrary here and be like, actually, Dishy Dez was overrated and he should be cancelled. But he was great. And he did he did do that thing, which was good, of not making it seem too important. He kind of had that. There's like Roger Moore raised eyebrow, which
yes, I know. Fair enough. I mean, levity's good. I mean, and if you've got a, you know, good solid reputation behind you to deliver it, that's kind of all right. So okay, the Dez London Appreciation Society have won here. Clearly, he can be our main guy, but there's always who's going to present the kind of lower kind of group stage, not actually at the you know, City Centre Square studio kind of situation. Jim Rosenthal, I feel like, would be quite good for that because you could give him a game with 5 minutes notice, Nick, and he'd style it out completely. He's Jim Rosenthal. He's the voice of sport.
Oh, yeah, 100%. He'd already have his blazer on. He'd be prepped and ready to go. But if you can't get Rosenthal, I just associate those sort of games with Matt Smith. Just your classic kind of ITV, like... The ITV Champions League highlight
show. Highlights.
Yeah. That's on slightly too late to, you know, to bother to stay up to watch. But he's absolutely perfect for that.
If he's not around Manish.
Matt Smith is a brilliant equivalent of like a really important 12th man squad player, isn't he? Like you just know he'll come in and do a really good job in lots of different positions.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, good choices, good balance. In our punditry roles then, I mean, it's a bit like a squad selection scenario, Charlie. You do need that balance. You need that mix of flair and authority and all that sort of stuff. But there are kind of recurring roles when it comes to BBC and ITV punditry. I feel like they always need one kind of suave, big-budget continental who maybe in the 90s would have been like the housewife's choice, but now these days it's just more like showing off your budget. So this year there's Klinsmann on the BBC. Thierry Henry pulled out.
And Fabregas.
He's pulled out. He's actually going to the tournament, which is... pretty big time, but they've got Fabregas and Klinsmann.
Fabregas is great.
Kind of real kind of authority.
Yeah, he's very much that role. And again, I mean, Ruud Gullit kind of kicked this off, didn't he, in Euro 96 with Sexy Football, etc. And then, it became a bit of an arms race. And it may be, I mean, the nadir arguably was Cannavaro. Was it at the 2014 World Cup where it seemed a little bit like, you know,
too much of a big name, but nothing.
Lectured by Martin O'Neill about how many Euro
about the Champions League. Yeah, amazing. But I like as well the new, a slightly newer role now, and I'm a big fan of this because I always wanted this in football punditry, was more recently retired players, because it always felt previously that you've got people talking about football who haven't played football for so long. And so I love how many kind of, what seemed to me as if they could still be playing, you know, so you look at your James McFadden's, your Ashley Williams's, your James Collins's. And I love, you've got, I think BBC have James Collins, then ITV, like, "We Raise You," Rob Earnshaw. And it's really good. And, I, you know, I think someone like Mika Richards has done loads for this because he is someone who, you know, is a lot younger and has been so good that I think everyone's kind of looking for the next Micah Richards.
Okay, so let's start pinning down some names. I mean, we can get into our Suave Continentals in a moment again, Nick, but for our sceptical domestic voice, we need Martin O'Neill, don't we? Because he's capable of sort of stopping someone and saying, actually, I don't think that's quite right, even if it's something about really silly like Robbie Williams' back catalogue.
Yeah, and as you say, the nice thing about O'Neill is you can... There's always a slight sense that he's going to say something eccentric, just do something weird, like I suppose, you know, lecturing Fabio Cannavaro about how many European Cups he's won, or, you know, famously a huge sort of true crime enthusiast. Maybe he can kind of riff on that for some inexplicable reason. But even if he doesn't, there's always the sense that it might happen, which is almost enough. It's almost enjoyable enough.
But in terms of the big continental name, Hullett, I mean, obviously was a breakthrough moment for the BBC, Charlie, with the whole sexy football thing, of course. In my eyes, he kind of overstayed his welcome a bit because he rocked up on Match of the Day a few times as well, wearing his own brand of clothes. Rude Hullett clothing. They had a logo on. That's not BBC.
That feels like advertising. Yeah,
That's disqualified for that reason alone. I feel like Klinsmann is a kind of clever little shout by them because he's just got that kind of transatlantic accent as well, which is just a bit like, whoa, what am I listening to? This is kind of cool.
Klinsmann's very sort of, I think, corporate sheen. But to me, he's a bit... I think Fabregas is more in that sweet spot because he's younger and... I don't know where. I mean, as you mentioned the housewives' favorite thing earlier, which, you know, again, it probably belongs to the 90s. But I'm sure Fabregas, if he'd been, you know, doing it in 96, he would have been very much branded as that. Yeah. So I think he's almost Hullett's successor for this tournament.
The thing I want from that kind of genre of you know, big name is absolutely no connection to English football. The kind of so that they have the sort of vague sense of bafflement as to what's going on. That I like the idea that someone from the BBC or whatever has kind of thought, well, can we get Clarence Seedorf? And then called his agent up, and the agent has said that someone from England wants you to do TV during the Euros. what do you reckon? Sure, yeah. There's that vague sense of bafflement and not quite knowing what's going on with this. You know, the big name European. Also, this doesn't quite fit with Seedorf, but there's also quite a nice thing with someone who's never played in England, and thus you are. And this is a very English thing to say. And thus you are slightly surprised that they speak English. Like Fabio Cannavaro has no practical reason to be fluent in English, and yet he was, which is kind of feeds into that English thing of being very impressed by people who could speak languages other than their own.
In a general sense, Charlie, I think we may well have passed this point quite a few years ago. We could have said this in 2014, 2016, 2018. Are we now at a point where kind of lazy international tournament punditry, let me start that again. Are we now at a point where lazy international tournament punditry simply will not be tolerated? Because I feel like this tournament, we're not going to get too much of, well, we know what to expect from the Swedes. They'll be organised. They'll be tough to break down. You know, they'll be well drilled. I don't think we're going to get much of that at this tournament. I feel like we've moved on.
The perennial slow starters and that sort of thing, the infighting in the Dutch camp. Yeah, I think so. I mean, this... And we've spoken about it before, but the Mark Lawrenson World Cup 2018, which I think sort of crystallised that debate of, you know, that you can, with a certain audience, you can no longer get away with those sort of things. But yeah, you know, and it used to be the case, didn't it? That'd be sort of like giving each other a bit of banter, like, oh, he's done his research, he's done his homework.
Yes. It's like a real novelty to have actually done
if Martin O'Neill, you know, seemed to actually know who the Czech Republic's right winger was, like, ooh, someone's done research. Whereas now I think the sort of Gary Nevilleification of punditry means, you know, it's actually quite impressive to know your stuff. So, yeah, I think we won't be hearing about, the slow-starting Italians and any other cliches.
Speaking of Gary Neville, Nick, ITV have got Gary Neville on loan from Sky from Tom, which is quite a nice touch when they get the pay TV big lads on loan for the summers if they've been called up by their national teams. But the ITV panel this year, it's serious stuff. We've got Wrighty, obviously, Roy Keane, Gary Neville, Patrick Vieira, Graham Soonish and Ashley Cole. That's their kind of real kind of lead headliners for their punditry. That's a serious set of names and views.
It is, but I sort of don't like the pundits out of context thing. Because I don't know, Gary Neville and Graham Souness on ITV just feels wrong.
I think, Charlie, I mean, you look at the BBC's panel, it's still big names. Rio Ferdinand, Michael Richards, The Athletic's Alan Shearer, of course, Alex Scott, Jermaine Genus. I mean, you know what to expect from these guys, but I feel like ITV have really pushed the boat out. So for once, I'm siding with them. I think they've won the battle. But they also, ITV Charlie, have also got Peter Walton. What a life he's got. What a life he's currently living.
I mean, yeah.
I bet you can't believe his
life. That is an extraordinary appointment. That people, that ITV have watched him on BT Sport and been like, yeah, we need a bit of that. But like,
yeah.
I mean, if you're ever in any doubt as to why we're where we are with things like VAR, you have to remember that it's people like Peter Walton who are kind of running the show, and that I think sort of makes things a lot clearer. But actually, like I feel like ITV often do have the better lineup on paper, and you go in thinking maybe I'll watch them, but then it is just
you're never going to choose them in a head-to-head.
Exactly, yeah. Like
that's the tricky. Yeah, one. I don't know anymore. I'm very confused. It used to be such a cast iron decision for me, Nick, and now I'm like, I just don't know. Which is credit to ITV, to be fair.
For the referee spot, well, I would like Dermot Gallagher, but I'd want him to do it in his actual Irish accent.
He has to do all the accents from the British Isles, depending on who's playing. Which I reckon he can pull it off. I'm aware that we haven't actually selected any names here, but I'm enjoying just the general overview here. The BBC's co-commentators for this tournament, Jermaine Genus, Martin Keown and Danny Murphy. That's a worry for me. That's like England's actual defence. I'm a bit concerned. We're a bit threadbare.
Yeah, I did get my hopes up slightly, but I did, having not seen Danny Murphy's face on the... The face that springs to mind when you think of someone's done his research thing. The yeah. kind of, you know, the lad who's poking fun at the dweebs.
Or even now it's more just like, you're overcomplicating it. They're just not good enough. Like it's kind of it's not even like you're overthinking more even than just you've done your research. But he feels like the Loro successor, doesn't he? They're kind of, you know, they've got to not be too over-enthusiastic.
The real tragedy of Euro 2020, Nick, is that the team news at ITV, McCoist in, champion out, open brackets, ESPN.
Oh, my God.
That's a huge shame.
Well, I mean, surely ITV could have directed some money away from, you know, Souness or whoever. And I mean, it was 2018, it was the World Cup, wasn't it, where that partnership really blossomed. So why... Carrying the momentum forward to the next tournament.
No, I completely agree. It is a shame, but I feel like Tilsley can carry that on. If they partner Tilsley and McCoist, that could work.
Yeah, that's true.
Charlie, I mean, Tilsley's got enough about him. He hasn't got the pressure of the big England games anymore. He can enjoy it.
Yeah, I do think, I feel like Tilsley can let his hair down a little bit. He's sort of, as you say, he's no longer having to do all the most pressured games. Yeah, possibly. It is the same. And, you know, we enjoyed Champion McCoist this season. They appeared together on Prime a couple of times on, you know, your sort of Southampton Wolves kind of games. It was perfect.
What I quite like from Clive is that he gets so relaxed that he starts plugging A, his book, and B, his commentary charts just in the middle of games, just for, you know, completely out of context.
like we heard it wearing his own clothes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I suspect he might. The first glimpse the other day, Charlie, of Gabriel Clark reporting from the England camp. Mm-hmm. That to me is when the tournament cycle really begins.
Yeah.
When Gabriel Clark is ensconced in wherever England are. He straddles the line between over earnest, like an overwrought. I mean, it is just football. And sort of professional so well.
Mm.
Like he really does. I mean, every update from the England camp, which is often quite a mundane thing, quite boring, maybe nothing has happened. I feel like it's appointment viewing when Gabriel Clark is telling me.
The thing I like about Gabriel Clark is that he has a sort of parallel career as a respected and a very good documentary film producer now. And this is clearly just his sort of, I don't know, his side gig now. But you're right, the seriousness of it with which he takes it, the comforting nature of the format. You can sort of predict to the sort of millisecond the long pause that he takes, and you know there's always a kind of same kind of camera shot of someone smacking the ball into the net in training, which goes slightly out of focus, and then it goes back into focus on the guy that scored.
It's amazing how much work does go into these training camp dispatches. It's genuinely really impressive. So long. I mean, if the BBC ever poached Gabriel Clark, that would be the next. That'd be like Dez going to ITV for me. That would be huge. Anyway, I think we haven't really selected any names there at all, but I think we've got a good vibe of what we like and dislike about our studio lineups. Back to the pitch now, Nick. I've simply written here goal scoring. Not sure what we're supposed to do here, but producer Dave has pointed out that we should decide whether we want golden/silver goals at our fantasy tournament. Where do you stand on this?
This is the thing. The golden goal is now such a sort of anachronism. When was it last in place? 2002, something like that.
Yeah.
That enough time has passed for me to think to have gone through the logical cycle and now think actually that does sound like a really exciting idea. Because it is in theory, it's a very sort of dramatic.
It's a noble endeavor.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very sort of slightly artificial, but a very dramatic sort of construct. So yeah, and fuck it, bring it back. we know that it doesn't work. We know that what it actually generally leads to is 30 minutes of extremely cagey football. But you know, it's such a good theory that you know maybe it can work again.
Charlie, the argument against golden goal is often that it feels anticlimactic. I mean, it doesn't perform the function it was almost designed to do. But I don't know, maybe it's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, Bierhoff's winner in 96 did feel a bit anticlimactic. But then Trezeguet's for France in 2000 felt exactly what the golden goal had been designed to do. Like a really good goal deciding a game between two big teams that really shouldn't go to penalties because that's not the way to decide this, etc., etc. So if anything, that's the poster goal, if a phrase could ever exist, for the golden goal, isn't it?
I mean, it's just funny that they used a European Championship to experiment. You know, you'd think this would be a sort of pre-season Intertoto Cup or something. They're like, let's just go...
You've seen the mascots. They don't care. They just don't care.
Let's just go straight in and do the Euros. It's never been tried. Yeah. Could work. Turns out it didn't. The slightly strange compromise of a silver goal that we saw in 2004.
That was a bad halfway house. I mean, Nick, do you know the name of the scorer of the only silver goal in Euros history?
Was it Greece?
Yes. It was Greece against Czech Republic.
So I watched a documentary about this 2 days ago and I've already forgotten. I'm going to say, just going to say Karasdeas because I assume he scored.
Delas, is that his name?
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, former Sheffield United centre-half, Trinos Delas. The silver goal both flawed it as a concept and didn't have its kind of memorable moment either, apart from being a sort of really boring quiz question. So we definitely don't want a silver goal, but how do we feel about gold? And we don't want that either. We don't want it.
Probably.
Penalties are okay.
I'm going to say yes for the golden goal while knowing that I'm wrong.
Yeah, this is not a debate I'd ever want to have in any arena. So let's move swiftly on. We've roughly designed this tournament. We have the nuts and bolts of it, some more important than others. Charlie, who are your iconic winners? Which team deserve to win this fantasy perfect Euros from its history? Which team kind of define
Euros have traditionally been good in that you have had these slightly strange winners. You know, we know about Denmark in 92, obviously Greece in 2004, Portugal last time. So in a way, I think you want that. On the other hand, I do think the Euros have often represented the kind of high watermark of football because Euro 2000, I mean, that tournament was just amazing. And that France team that won Euro 2000 was far better than the France team that won the World Cup 2 years ago. I mean, it was basically the same team, but get rid of Givarch and bring in Henri and Elka and Trezeguet. You know, Henri and Trezeguet were at 98, they were far better by 2000. So I think so either you go for one of those underdogs or the other, like France, that Spain team that won the Euros both in 08 and then 2012, and that kind of bookmarked them as being the absolute best. So, yeah, I don't know. It depends how romantic or otherwise you want to go, I suppose.
I quite like the kind of completism of a team following up a World Cup by winning the Euros, Nick. I feel like that makes, I mean, almost by definition, the most solid winner. Then there is those storylines of the unexpected winners, your Denmarks, your Greeces, which are an important part of Euro's tapestry. But where do you stand on this?
I think
if you indeed have a position, yeah,
I think you must. What I like is maybe a very journalist thing, but I like a kind of story arc, a team that this was true of Spain, I suppose, a team who have been good for a while but not won anything. Finally, kind of, you know, getting the realizing yes. their potential, all that. Adam, his face is giddy with
anticipation here.
So I want a final between that team and the complete outsider: Spain in 2008 and Greece in 2004.
Okay, I was going to throw Holland 88 into the mix just because every picture of them lifting the trophy and or participating in Euro 88 looks really, really nice. Which I don't think is quite enough to qualify them, but still looks really nice. Can't really look past Spain, can we? But I do like France 98 and 2000, as Charlie specified. So I think I might have to go with them. That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it has to be one of those two teams as one of the finalists. And I like that idea of one of them, but then against United 2 Denmark or your Greece 2004. Or, I mean, Portugal 2016, they're probably not quite at that level, are they? But they were certainly a big surprise given how they did in the groups.
Okay, here's the semi-finals then. France 2000 versus Denmark 92, and then Greece 2004 versus Holland 88. And let's see where it all goes from there. I'm sure it'd be lovely. Decided in spawny fashion, no doubt. More importantly for this situation, Charlie, where's your final being held? I have a very Euro venue in mind. I just want to see if anybody else says it. What's the most European stadium you can think
yeah,
of?
Yeah, this is quite a tricky one. The most Euro. I think I might have it in Holland, in Rotterdam, somewhere like that. That feels like a very... exactly. That feels to me very Euro-y.
2000 final venue, of course. Nick, what's in your mind?
I think it is the Olympiastadion in Munich in 1988. It's got a running track. It has lots of iconic kind of moments. Really kind of unusual stadium design. Yeah, I'm going with that.
Both very solid nominations. I mean, both conjure up very vivid
images. But you're wrong.
but I just want to throw a third option into the mix, which is a stadium that everybody's heard of but no one can picture, and yet has a very solid place in European football history. More to the point, sits pretty much smack bang in the middle of Europe as well, and that's the Ernst Happel Stadion.
I thought you were going to say that. Yeah, I thought you were going to go Ernst Happel.
Dramatic, weighty historical things happen at the Ernst Happel Stadion in Vienna.
And I've got it. The opening credits can have Mozart playing in the background, perhaps.
Exactly.
I did think about that, but I disqualified on the basis that the camera angle was too low.
Fair enough. Yeah. And you knew that would strike me in the middle of my heart as well. For that reason alone, I'm almost tempted to get rid of it. But no, I put a lot of thought into it, so no. So that's our fantasy perfect European championships. We've got 16 teams. We've got the Adidas Questa Europa as our ball. Slight amount of colour, but nothing too garish. We've got a rabbit as our mascot. Inoffensive, slightly creative, but nothing that's going to rock the boat too much. As our theme tune, we've got slightly bouncy effort from Euro 2016 on the BBC. Des Lynam opening the affairs, backed up by Matt Smith and Jim Rosenthal for the kind of secondary and highlight situation. That's a very strong. We don't care who our pundits are. It's all very, very much a mixed bag anyway. But we know we want one suave continental in there at least. Fabregas, a very good shout this year. We're not having the golden goal, controversially, but we're certainly not going to debate it at any length. Straight to penalties for all our semi-finalists, which are Denmark 92, France 2000, Holland 88, and Greece 2004, which have been arbitrarily selected. All reaching its crescendo at the Ernst Happel Stadion in Vienna. But there is one final thing for us to decide. That is, what's going to be the official film of our Fantasy Euro tournament? Now, there isn't a rich history, much like mascots, Nick, of official films in Euro's history. But there is one very, very interesting example. Sandwiched between the genuinely legendary Mexico 1986 film Hero, which was narrated by Michael Caine, and the Italia 90 official film, which was narrated by Edward Woodward, is the Euro 1988 official film, named Tor, which is German for goal, of course. Now, with all those heavyweight narrators, Nick, the choice for this one was Red Dwarf and Coronation Street's Craig Charles. Sensational! I have no idea how he came to land that gig.
The thing you want from any sort of football documentary is surprisingly big name. So, you know, Michael Caine, and obviously with the Spurs
documentary. You want gravitas, yeah, right?
It's the Spurs documentary recently. It was Tom Hardy, wasn't it? You think, how did that happen? But yeah. But yeah, Craig Charles, unless you know, he was a stratospherically big name in 1988 and we just can't remember it. Yeah, very odd.
Charlie, the only reason I really wanted to shoehorn this final category into proceedings is simply for the clip that I'm going to play this episode out with, which is the very, very fascinating way that Craig Charles pronounced the name of the Ireland goalkeeper throughout this official film. Here, indeed, is 30 seconds of Craig Charles pronouncing Pat Bonner's name.
Bonner in the Irish goal begins to measure out his answer. In Dublin, they can only pray that Bonner's athletic nerve and luck will see it through. Bouters, Bonner off his line. Bonner safe. From nothing, Koeman's shot glances off Keith's head and bobbles apologetically, spinning wide at the brave Bonner.
The most childish moment in the Football Clichés podcast's history. Anyway, hope everyone enjoys the Euros. That was essentially our fantasy version of what we would like to see, but I'm sure the real thing will be just as good, no matter what kind of combination of elements we have. What we should say is that the Football Clichés will be with you for the entire tournament, because we're going 2 episodes a week, bringing you, as David Ornstein famously said on the trailer recently, an alternative look at the tournament storylines. See everyone very, very soon indeed. Bye.
The Athletic.